Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Murder Book, a new true crime podcast hosted by best-selling author Michael Connelly, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Also, be sure to check out Dark Sacred Night, Michael Connelly's latest number one bestseller, featuring detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, February 18th, 2019, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Now, this week we have a fascinating show, but before we dive into it, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because I depend on support from listeners just like you, along with the ad revenue that I collect for the show. You know, I'm producing it, booking it. I have to pay my amazing assistant, Noelle Dilworth, as well as the editing company that I'm working with because I'm juggling so many things at this point. And so you guys really, really do help out. I want to thank the top patrons who have pledged who have pledged their support on patreon.com/talknerdy. And they include Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Now, that's one way you can support the show, but you can also rate, review on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, tell your friends and family about it, and visit talknerdymerch.com to buy some cool swag that would also support the show. All right, enough about that. Let's talk about this week's episode. So I had the honor to sit down, well, not with directly, over Tay Internet, with Dr. Livia Eberlin. She is a Sao Paulo-born chemist who is currently a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And she does incredible work. Not only was she listed as a Forbes 30 under 30 in science and healthcare, she's also a MacArthur Genius Grant award-winning fellow. And she, with her team, developed this incredible technology called the mass spec pen. It's huge, and we're going to tell you all about it. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Livia Eberlin. Well, Livia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm really excited with this opportunity.
Absolutely. So, oh my gosh, there's so many cool things that we can talk about. There's so much cool stuff that has been happening in your life recently. But I think maybe just to start it off, we should orient a little to who you are and what you do. So you are technically a chemist, but you work in, you use these chemistry techniques for a medical purpose, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So what is your focus?
I tend to say people here, and actually, we were just interviewing a faculty candidate, and I told him right ahead, look, I'm the least chemist in this department because, you know, like through my PhD and postdoc, I really found very clearly within me that my passion was in applied research. Mm-hmm. And through my interactions in hospitals and like working with clinicians and surgeons and pathologists and like seeing like their patients and so on, really where it clicked for me that, you know, a lot of like the really cool and like cutting edge chemical instrumentation and techniques that we were developing at PhD students could make huge impact like on everyday clinical practice. But, you know, it was really lacking an aspect of making these tools accessible to doctors.
Gotcha.
So that's really when I started to think, okay, how can we really get out of this incredible chemical technology that we have that are mostly in the basement of academic institutions or in R&D and industry? How can we adapt them in a way that we can really make them accessible and make an impact on the life of patients and clinicians every day? So that's why, you know, my research from that day on has been really focused on improving and adapting chemical methods in health-related problems. And I'm particularly interested in cancer research. So that's really, you know, what we do routinely in my lab.
Very cool. And so you use a technology called mass spectrometry. And we've talked a little bit on the show in the past about spectroscopy. We've had a guest on, Holly Bender, who is an optical engineer who makes the lenses for, you know, NASA projects at JPL for spectroscopy. But that's different from spectrometry, isn't it?
That is different. So spectroscopy normally is basing measurements on light, mm-hmm. interaction of matter with light. And so these are like optical techniques. And spectrometry, in the case of mass spectrometry, we're actually measuring mass of molecules. And that's done with electrical fields, but not necessarily with optical, radiation and so on. So with mass spec, we're really detecting specific mass to charge ratios of different compounds. And what's really impressive about this technology is the sensitivity and specificity in molecular analysis. So we can detect very small quantity of material, and we can get just incredible molecular information on the components of just complex, which can be, you know, like clinical samples like tissues, blood, and serum, but can also be, you know, samples or in pharma and so on. So the applications are really huge and broad, and it's a really high performance technology.
So to kind of orient people who are listening a little bit, are these the machines that when you're watching a show like CSI, they put a sample of something into the machine and then it has all these squiggly lines to read out and they're like, ah, there's nitrogen in this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so mass spec is used broadly, like, you know, if you think about detection of, like in the Olympics games and when they're doing all of the analysis of drugs, you know, in blood and serum and so on, that's what they use. They use mass spectrometry to know exactly what the compounds is and how much you have in the samples. And yeah, so actually mass spec was featured in CSI a few times in doing these type of analysis. And what we developed was also featured in Grey's Anatomy, which was pretty cool. They actually had a mass spectrometer in the show, like a model. But it was really cool to see, they represented pretty well the output, right, of the measurement. So that was really neat.
Oh, very cool. And so mass spec has been around for not a really, really long time, but it's been around for a bit. What makes the mass spec that you're using in your lab different? What is the medical application there?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So mass spectrometry has been traditionally used in combination with chromatography. So some type of separation technique. And traditionally, even especially if you're working from a complex sample, you have to do a lot of data of sample treatment. So in an assay, you'd waste or take most of your time just preparing a sample. So you're going to, homogenize it, and then you're going to do some type of extraction, and then you're going to purify it and so on. And then you can do the analysis. What we've done in my research is we skipped all of the sample prep steps, which are really time consuming and just, detrimental to real time analysis. And we went straight to the mass spec. So we literally get a sample and directly analyze it with mass spectrometry. And the mass spectrometry measurement is extremely fast. So you can get a mass spectrum in less than a second. So if you think about it, if you can get the level of, molecular measurements in a second from a complex sample, like a tissue sample, then you can really start thinking about applications, right, in clinical practice. And that's what we did, especially with the development of the mass spec pen. The really innovative part of the research was making a device that is handheld, easy to use, biocompatible, non-destructive to tissue, the autoclavable, and easy to incorporate into clinical workflow, and connecting that directly to a mass spectrometer. So now you have this interface that allows you to very easily analyze samples, and you get instantaneous chemical information, molecular information that's highly predictive and characteristic of disease state of a tissue is more and more cancer tissue. That interface and that capability of doing measurements in real time is really what's innovative and different about research.
Wow. So, you've been talking about samples and how historically samples had to be prepped, homogenized, cleaned, separated, all these different steps. But what you're doing now with your interface that you guys designed is just actually taking a sample right then and there. And basically your interface connects it directly to the machine that analyzes it. So when we say sample, what do we mean? Are we talking about like a piece of a tumor? Are we talking about a biopsy?
Yeah. So when we approached in the lab, we were working with pieces of tissues, human tissues that were collected from surgery. So these were either normal tissues that were removed or cancer tissues that were removed from the patient. So we literally had a piece of tissue. We have hundreds of pieces of tissues from humans in the lab. And we developed a method with these, what we say, ex vivo tissues, meaning they were outside of the body. Now we're actually currently testing the method in the operating room. So we have a mass spectrometer installed in an operating room, and we're taking measurements inside of the human body. So the samples now really are tumor and normal tissues that are living in human, in patients, and seeing how the performance of our methods really are, right, in comparison to the standard clinical workflow. So it's just really cool. So the mass spec pen is, you know, it looks like not a pen, but the surgeon will hold it, literally hold it to the tissue. And then we use a single water droplet to extract molecules from the tissue. And that's directly inserted into the mass spectrometer through tubing. And that provides real-time analysis of tissues. So we can do that in the human body, so living tissues, as well as outside and biopsies and so on. But, you know, what we're really excited about are definitely the in vivo studies in the patients.
That's incredible. So what is it that would potentially be in a tumor that doctors would need to have the mass spec analyze? Like, what kinds of signals are they looking for, and what would that information empower them to do?
Yeah. So these are two really good questions too. We're mostly looking at metabolites and lipids. And in a lot of recent research in metabolomics, looking at expression of small molecules in tumors, and a lot of previous discoveries that show that there's an alteration of metabolism in cancer cells. So the metabolites in the cancer cell are expressed at different abundances and then compared to a normal cell. So we are able to extract these compounds with a water droplet and then analyze them with mass spectrometry. So you normally think of disease diagnostics with proteomics or gene expression, but we're really looking at the end products, right? Like glucose, glutamine, small molecules that are easily removed from tissue. So I like to talk about it to my students and so on. It's a very basic chemical process. Liquid extraction is super basic, right? We do that every day when we're making a coffee. We use water to extract compounds from the coffee powder. And we take a shower every day and we're extracting compounds from our body. Mm-hmm. So in the same sense, we can use water to extract compounds, mostly small molecules, metabolites from cells. And then we can train our methods to where they're good enough, right, using machine learning and artificial intelligence to know that that pattern of molecules characterizes disease or cancer or normal tissues. So that information can really be transformative in clinical practice, because when a surgeon's performing a tissue, just performing a surgery, if they're just like looking at the gross anatomy of these organs, it can be really hard for them to know where to stop cutting. Yeah. So you think about a tumor, and it's not like a ball, right? Like the margin, like the boundary between cancer and normal tissue is not that easily to be observed by a naked eye. So if you give them the possibility of using a molecular technology to in real time probe and analyze, okay, here's where the tumor ends, here where it stops, and then I removed all of it, you can really potentially change, you know, the outcome for these patients, because now hopefully you're getting all the tumor out in one surgery. There's last second surgeries, recurrence is lower. So, you know, all of the clinical data shows that that would really improve patient care. And another thing too is like the type of molecular information we get with mass spectrometry is so rich that we can even subtype tumors. So information that wouldn't be available in the OR, but we could tell the surgeon, you know, it's this type of tumor, you know, there's this kind of clinical pattern and so on. So I'd say that, you know, we're really empowering the surgeon with extra information that wouldn't be available and can really help them make better decisions in the treatment for the patient.
Wow. So what I'm gathering from this, and I think anybody who has had a bout with cancer or who has had somebody that they know and love struggling with this disease, is that cancer, like you said, tumors aren't like these perfect little, they're not invasive pieces of meat. It's your own tissue that's transforming and growing. So being able to tell the difference between cancer and non-cancer, it's a fuzzy boundary. And what ends up happening is this trade-off of, we want to get all the cancer so it doesn't keep spreading, but we also don't want to destroy healthy tissue, especially in parts of the body where we can't live healthily with that tissue missing. So this helps empower the surgeons to remove exactly the right amount and not too much, which could in and of itself also be detrimental.
Yeah, that's a perfect description. I have a really good friend, Justin. He lives in California, and he was diagnosed very early with a brain tumor. And he told me right away, like, one of the first things when he came out of surgery, the one thing he wanted to know is, did you get it all out? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, been the case for several of the patients I've interacted with. I mean, is there, you know, anything more devastating than knowing after a surgery, you know, not all of the tumor has been removed or some have been missed, but you still have that chance of it coming back and, you know, having to have more, even more treatment. So that ability to help a surgeon make that decision could really, you know, change the outcome for the patients. And as you said, it's extremely important. It's a very clear example. You definitely don't want to take unnecessary normal tissue. Mm-hmm. But there's several other organs that if you remove too much, it really impacts quality of life. So if we can help surgeons make better decisions in real time, I think that could really change the outcome for the patients.
Absolutely. And of course, the second half of that is that you said that there's this specificity now. A surgeon, first of all, a very good trained surgeon might be able to see the difference between cancer tissue and non-cancer tissue, but even mm-hmm. that is difficult. Beyond that, they're not going to know what type of cancer necessarily. They're not going to know any of the molecular qualities of the cancer. But if there is a tumor that's in a really tricky place that it's mm-hmm. just too dangerous to remove, but you find out, hey, this tumor has a molecular marker that makes it very targeted with very good treatments, chemotherapies that won't destroy the healthy tissue around them because it only targets this molecular marker. That's a real boon for a patient. And to be able to find that out is amazing. And usually that requires invasive biopsies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And the reality of it is that in clinical practice today, you're always going to majority of the time, you're going to use that extracted tissue, right, to do further testing. Mm-hmm. So post-operatively, the margins will be checked, right? That's the standard clinical care. So you will know if the margins were clean or not. You will know the subtype of the cancer. They may run genetic testing to know more information. But if you are able to have that decision before, that information before surgery is completed, it can change, you know, it can change the course of the surgery. It may be that, you know, if the tumor is invading, critical area of the tissue, but then you know that it's a cancer type that's not as, you know, the prognosis is not as bad, then, you know, it may change how the surgeon decides to remove tissue or not. Mm-hmm. So, I think the ability to have that type of information in real time, it's kind of still mind blowing to me. From my experience in the OR and interactions with surgeons and so on, it would be something very interesting and important for them as well.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, I think that we often don't think of the scientific process as being one of technology development. I think in our minds, we think mm-hmm. of science and technology as being two separate buckets. And perhaps it's because that's how the media has sort of sliced and diced artificially the way that we talk about these stories. But of course, in order to do good science and even do good clinical work, we have to have the appropriate technology. And it's really cool to see that as a chemist, as somebody who's been studying these processes for so long, you saw a problem and said, maybe we can build something that can solve this problem. Did you ever set out to see yourself as kind of an inventor of sorts?
Yeah, there's something really cool about being called an inventor. I actually got this question another day. And, you know, this is my branch of chemistry. So I'm in analytical chemistry. And it's normally like looked as like a less important area of chemistry compared to organic or inorganic and theoretical chemistry. But I like to say that analytical is a really cool branch of chemistry because we are in the forefront of developing technology, methodology in USAs that have immediate implications and impact in, you know, people's lives and in just the world. So I think, you know, being in analytical chemistry has really given me an edge of tools and technologies and capabilities and performance. And what I think is important for people that are like using science to develop new technology is to be able to identify the right problems and come up with good solutions that will actually be used. So this process of, you know, kind of like bridging different disciplines can, I think, only be done if you really are doing it in teams, right? So my interaction with clinicians were really important for me to see, okay, how can we, I guess, invent something that would really be used by clinicians? Because scientists, we can think, you know, like, oh, this would be really cool. But then you put it in the hand of a clinician that's think, oh my gosh, I'll never use this. It's not in the right way. You know, like it wouldn't fit in our clinical workflow. Mm-hmm. So having that interaction really enables and expedites like inventions and discoveries that are truly applicable to the, you know, pressing health problems.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned that the mass spec pen, this research tool that you guys are working on that does sort of in vivo testing, is autoclavable. I mean, just something as simple as that, to be able to sterilize it, which it can't be easy with, you know, sensitive electronics. It's absolutely essential. If you can't get this thing clean, clinicians aren't going to be able to use it.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And that's something we thought from the very beginning of the project, and we had to treat materials, put the electronics in right places, right, at the non-disposable components to make sure that it would be easily incorporated into the clinical workflow. So we actually make all of them in my lab, like my students, and put them together, and we ship them to the hospital, and then they just autoclave it through their standard clinical procedures. So it's just really cool to see that, because when we go to the OR, it's actually one of the sterilized tools. You know, it's a research device. You know, it's like kind of already looks like it's within their clinical workflow. So it's just really cool to see that.
That's so cool. I mean, and for people who don't know, an autoclave is basically like a super hot oven, like a pressurized hot oven that gets up to, like, I'm looking it up right now, around 250 degrees Fahrenheit. Things go in there. They heat up really high with under a whole lot of pressure, and it basically sterilizes the equipment, you know, scalpels, and even at tattoo shops, like the little parts of the needles and all the tools that they use should have gone through an autoclave before they're used, just to get all the bacteria and things that could potentially make you sick.
Yeah.
I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Murder Book, the new true crime podcast hosted by bestselling author Michael Connelly. Murder Book helps Michael Connelly return to his roots as a journalist, because this is true crime. It is not fiction. He works with the very detectives who inform his novels and his hit television show, Bosch, and it explores real homicide cases not covered by mainstream media. Murder Book Season 1 is The Telltale Bullet, and it dives into a 30-year Hollywood carjacking gone wrong that tests the limits of the American criminal justice system. Guys, Michael Connelly also has a brand new book called Dark Sacred Night. It's his latest number one bestseller. It features detectives Harry Bosch and Renee Ballard, and you can find it wherever books are sold. Now, not only do I love his books, I love this podcast. I'm a little bit of a sucker for good true crime. I have to admit it, and it really doesn't disappoint. So make sure that you check out Michael Connelly's new Murder Book podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever wherever you download, or you can visit murderbookpodcast.com. Again, that's murderbookpodcast.com. I also want to thank Eero for their support of the show. Eero is awesome, you guys. It's a next generation home Wi-Fi system that's like enterprise level, and it really does improve upon anything that you could possibly be using right now. I mean, think about it. The single router model, it just doesn't work. We need more bandwidth. Just like a light bulb, Wi-Fi doesn't go through walls well, so you can't light your whole house with a single light bulb. Why would you use that individual focus for all of your Wi-Fi? You need a distributed system. And I mean, this is what offices have always had. It's what Eero gives you. You can install an enterprise grade Wi-Fi system in your home in only a few minutes. You can manage it from an app that's right there in the palm of your hand. You figure out what's connected, how many devices, you know how well it's working. It's got state of the art WPA2 encryption. Guys, it's amazing. And it also has this awesome combination where you can get Eero Plus, which offers the ability to block malicious and unwanted content across your entire network. There's advanced security, content blocking, and ad blocking. So you've got, you know, the ability to browse and to stream faster than you were ever able to before. There's third-party security apps, VPN protection, password management, and antivirus software all built in. I have it in my house. It's been a massive improvement, I can tell you. And I think what was the best, because I'm not that techie, is that I was able to set it up really, really fast, completely customize my entire house. And now, like I said, I can control it super easy from the app. So guys, never think about Wi-Fi again. You can get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package and 1 year of Eero Plus. All you've got to do is visit Eero.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy at checkout. Again, that's Eero.com/nerdy and enter nerdy at checkout. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
Oh my gosh, this is like so fascinating. And of course, you've been on a long journey to get here, even though you still have so much more journey ahead of you, because you're a very young researcher. You're still in the earliest stages of your career. But I want to take a few steps back. So right now, you're on faculty at the University of Texas Austin at UT. Prior to that, you did your postdoc at Stanford. And prior to that, you got your PhD at Purdue. So these are all American institutions, but you got your undergraduate degree back where you're from in Brazil. What was that transition like, doing science in Brazil and then moving to the States to do science? And I have to assume, you know, leaving a lot of your friends, your family, back home in order to start a second chapter.
Yeah, it was really hard. Actually, the transition from Brazil to Indiana.
Yeah, it's a big change.
A very contrasting culture and environment and weather and so on. So it wasn't easy. I remember when I came to my first class in my PhD studies at Purdue, I was literally listening to the lecture in English and translating it into my mind to Portuguese. And then I would write the notes in Portuguese. And wow. It was just like so complex. You know, learning something in a second language can be really challenging. But, you know, my attitude has been always of like this feeling of extreme privilege to actually being able to undertake that kind of career path. I received a fellowship early on in Brazil when I was an undergraduate student. And I was doing research back there as well, with the opportunity to come to the U.S. and do research here. And, you know, the talent is not different, I would say. I think that people in Brazil are equally talented as scientists mm-hmm. in the U.S., but just the resources and the opportunities here are so much more than in Brazil. So in some way, the research here is accelerated by that. And, you know, you have this incredible environment of support for scientific research, which still missing in Brazil. And you know, as generally speaking, so I've, you know, it was a challenge to move and come abroad, and, you know, my family's still in Brazil, But I really feel like it was a blessing to be able to do that and now have the career path that I've had and all the way here to UT, where also, again, just an incredible environment for research.
Oh, wow. You know, have you seen the film Science Fair, the new documentary by Christina Costantini and Darren Foster?
I have not.
Oh, I highly recommend it. I had the opportunity to talk to them on the show a few weeks, maybe months ago now. And they made this really lovely documentary about the International Science Fair. And, they followed a handful of students in their work, you know, leading up to the science fair and then competing in the science fair. And one of the teams of people that they followed was a team from Brazil, a young woman and man who are, I think, probably a little bit later in their high school careers. And it was really interesting. And they were from a very small town in Brazil. And it was really interesting to see, you know, the kinds of challenges that they were up against as compared to a relatively wealthy team of students in America or even in Germany, you know, not having a lot of community support, although, you know, their families were so proud and their schools were so proud, but just not having some of the tools and even the travel funds available to be able to go and compete. But they were doing research on Zika virus, which was just so important. And it was really cool to see it happening. I highly recommend it.
That's cool. Yeah. There are things that we don't notice. Like, we forget. Like, I remember, like, in Brazil, like, placing an order for, like, a chemical, it would be imported. So it would take, like, a month and a half to get a chemical.
Oh, wow.
And here, like, we're like, okay, just let's do, like, overnight shipping FedEx for this, and then we get it the next day. So these things really accelerated, changed the way that you do science in a way that, you know, it's really good here in the U.S. So it's definitely something that we can take for granted, but it's a special thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the hope is, and I think we are seeing more of a global community moving forward, right? Like, we used to be much more, I think, you know, putting politics aside and any sort of isolationist views from a political standing or a government standing aside, you know, regardless of who is trying to maintain an isolationist view in America, it doesn't hold anymore, because we cannot do good work without collaborating across boundaries, across, you know, global boundaries. And it's so cool to see, you know, the talent, like you mentioned, the talent's the same everywhere. It's just a function of how is it empowered to be able to do the great work. And it's so cool to see scientists from all over the globe collaborating with one another to solve these really important problems.
Yeah, that's, I would agree with all of that. Our research is hot. We have a collaboration now in Brazil, actually, one in Australia. So, and this interchange of also samples is very important for clinical research, right? To make sure you really sample a population that's broad enough so that, you know, your findings are truly significant, right, across some, you know, countries and different people. So that's very important as well.
So, you know, from what I've read about you, you started your interest in understanding and utilizing, and I guess I should say, iterating or improving mass spec pretty early on in your chemistry career, because you were interested in analytic chemistry. But when did that clinical switch occur? Because, of course, mass spec can be used for a lot of different purposes, and most people that work as chemists aren't necessarily chemists in, you know, in communication or in partnership with cancer biologists, for example.
Yeah. So when I was in Brazil, like, my very first project in mass spectrometry was investigating the reaction mechanism of these gas phase ion molecule reactions. You know,
so what,
like,
does that mean?
Right. Exactly. So we're trying to understand how these reactions happen in the gas phase using mass spectrometry. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is kind of cool. But I think, okay, most of reactions are, you know, that are being used today are in liquid phase. And, you know, the product is being formed. Why do we really need to understand this mechanism? So I really struggled with, you know, like this type of research, the basic research that I was that's the really application and power of it. But what I need was like, okay, mass spectrometry is awesome because the performance and capabilities of this technique is really unparalleled. So it wasn't until my PhD that I was exposed to more like biomedical research. And through interactions in hospitals, we were collaborating with IU, Indiana University Medical School, and Harvard Medical School. And really that interaction is where it really led me to, you know, understand the clinical needs and really become passionate in this field. But, you know, that interaction was really important in defining this application and focus in my career that, you know, as you said, you know, it was pretty distant from my first use of mass spectrometry in research.
It's so cool to see that, you know, there can be such crossover between, I think what we often use terms like basic research and applied research or translational research, you know, there's different terms that are thrown around, but to see that, you know, there's an opportunity for researchers' careers to really shift and change. And also that things that we consider, you know, I don't know, less essential or less understandable because they're at the basic level really fundamentally are still so important, even if they're not yet at the, you know, translational level.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is what we see like here in my department. You know, we have such a broad range of, you know, researchers and interests and, you know, potential problems that are being solved. And, you know, but personally for me, like I'm kind of like an immediate person. Like I want to do something that's going to change, you know, society maybe in 3 months. Maybe that's too fast. Maybe like in 2 years. So that's really what drives me, in my research and, you know, just, you know, my life in general. So, that kind of real application and immediate, you know, need was something that has always been really important for me.
Oh, that's really cool. We always joke on the other podcast that I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. You know, we cover all sorts of science topics every week. But the joke at the end of every new discovery or every new application is, yeah, it'll be on the market in about 5 to 10 years. It's always about 5 to 10 years down the road.
We actually say that for our stuff, too. It's just, you know, better be safe than sorry. So why not?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's so funny when we revisit things 5 or 10 years later, because the show's been on the air for so long. It's like, yeah, we'll just tack another 5 or 10.
Yeah, just add 10 more.
Well, you know, I found out about you and about your work because of some of the media attention that you've gotten lately around some really, you know, really high level awards. And you mentioned early on, you know, back when you were in Brazil, getting an undergraduate fellowship that really helped catapult your career. But of course, more recently, you were named Forbes is 30 under 30 in science and healthcare. You got the L'Oreal USA for Women in Science Fellowship, which is just massive. I mean, it's such an honor. And then just this past year, you were granted a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, which is huge. So how has that been, you know, dealing with some of the attention that that's brought to you, but also having some opportunities open up to you through the granting of some of these fellowships?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really cool. You know, the L'Oreal and the Forbes was when I was in a postdoc at Stanford. So I've passed 30 now. I'm 32. But you know, it's incredible program, especially the L'Oreal program, absolutely incredible. And I can tell you more about that, just the support and the community that's formed, was formed through that fellowship has really been transformative in my career. And the MacArthur, I mean, I'm still kind of like in disbelief. I'm still kind of pinching myself because I can't believe that, you know, when I got the call, I was still kind of shaking and like, no way. So, you know, it's really great. And it's really great. I think it's showing that what we're doing is really significant. It gives you that level of assurance and confidence that you're in the right track. So these things can really, you can really build your confidence in your career and in your path and so on. So it's been really fun, and I feel really, really honored to have received these. The MacArthur is really new. Also, you know, gatherings, and we get to know people, other fellows. So I'm really looking forward for that. And it's kind of what, going back to what you said, is that sense of community that is built with a lot of these awards. And that's really true to foundations and private companies that are granting these type of fellowships and awards. Like, they really building that into a network of scientists and that really support each other and what it means to do even better work in scientific research. So that's really what's been cool about these programs.
Yeah, I mean, how important when you are working kind of at a high level on something that's very conceptual, but also very practical. And of course, as it is right now, the work that you do is pretty multidisciplinary. Like, not everybody has the opportunity to already be branched out in multiple fields. But of course, scientists often find themselves stuck in like these heavy silos. And so how cool to be able to network and really learn from people who are, it almost seems like out of left field, working on projects that have nothing to do with the work that you do, but maybe you can be inspired and actually have some cool crossovers with them.
Yeah, absolutely. The MacArthur is really special because I think I'm one of three scientists that won out of the quota this year. So it's really like people in all types of areas, right? Like journalists and artists and people in social justice. And so it's really like human rights and everything. And so I'm really looking to, you know, like as a person, as an individual. I mean, of course, being a scientist is a big part of who I am, but that's not all about. So it's really neat to have a community. And, so the L'Oreal, it's special because it's for women as well. So that really is something that I value a lot. And I've kept in touch with the program and, with leadership at L'Oreal, for the L'Oreal for Women in Science, and actually have a research project with one of the fellows, in my year, one of the other fellows. So it's just been really fun to be part of that community.
Oh, and it's just so important. I mean, you know, I always work really hard to try and have gender parity. I'm trying also really hard on the podcast to feature more and more people of color within the sciences, which is, you know, it's a struggle for a lot of people in this field. It's a struggle because you don't want to tokenize certain individuals who are kind of everybody's go-to when they become interviewed. And that's, you know, really insulting. But because the field itself doesn't have the best track record and is now working really hard to close some of these gaps, of course, elevating individuals within the field, sometimes you have to work because there's just a whole lot of white men in the way. But, you know, the one thing I don't ever want to do as a woman in science myself is to ask those questions that you often hear. What's it like to be a woman in science? And like, you know, the woman version of a scientist, which is like just so insulting and horrible. But at the same time, you know, the conversations around helping to bridge the gap, helping to empower, provide support, and start to work on evening a playing field that is not at all level. And that's really the conversation to be had. It's so important. And it's really cool to see that a program like the L'Oreal Women in Science Fellowship, which is for women, actually does make huge waves. Like, it makes changes in people's careers, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think one of the key things about the For Women in Science Fellowship is bringing awareness and recognition to women so that we inspire younger women in the field. Because, you know, as you probably know the statistics, right? The issue right now really isn't getting girls in undergrad, right? We actually, I think, this last year granted more undergraduate degrees in chemistry to women than to men. The problem really is going up the ladder. So, like, in my I think we're 20% female faculty, and the rest is still man, mostly white men. So that's really where the disparity is. And I think bringing attention to women in science is important because you can really then have that role model for younger generations. And I would say Latin women. Most of the time when you think about Latin women, you think about, you know, artist, maybe, right? not necessarily a scientist. And like the numbers are really low of Latin women that are in scientific research or like leading, you know, scientific discoveries. So, you know, I like to bring awareness of that because I want, you know, girls in Brazil and in the U.S. of Latin origin and background, you know, they were equally talented, equally capable of pursuing a career like this, if that's our desire.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really, you're right. It's so important in the, or I should say in the STEM fields, right? Because let's not forget mm-hmm. math and engineering and places where there's also a real lack of parity. But also just like you mentioned, at the sort of highest levels of whether we're talking about academia or corporate America mm-hmm. or any place where there is a ladder, like the representation, it just dwindles when you're talking yeah. about the people who honestly have ultimate power and control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the real bummer, right? These fully tenured faculty positions, these board boardroom positions, C-level positions are very rarely sat by women and especially mm-hmm. women of color.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a topic of ongoing conversation. How do we reach that? I particularly think that, you know, change in policy is going to be very important to make that work. I mean, we have to actively pursue, you know, improve representation, not just, mm-hmm. you know, hope that it happens. And until we do that, I don't think it will really change. But I think the future and the expectation is pretty good. We're seeing change like right now. So, we're going in the right direction. I just think, you know, more policy and, changes need to be made to accelerate that process.
Absolutely. I mean, even in my own field, I'm, you know, back in psychology after many years in neuroscience, psychology is a really good example of something that used to be just there were no women allowed. And now it's mainly women in the field. But you still see a big difference between assistant professors, associate professors, mm-hmm. and tenured, you know, full professor faculties, or even when you compare like emeritus professors. So like mm-hmm. the older sect is still, you know, predominantly male. But of course, there's a whole new generation of women, and most psychology departments, at least across this country, are now predominantly female, which is a really cool change to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if that can be any model, I think we're also seeing it in the life sciences. It's happening a little bit quicker in the life sciences than in the physical sciences. And of course, you know, the places where it's most egregious are like engineering and computer science and mm-hmm. math departments and things like that. But it's cool to hear that even in chemistry, we're seeing like more and more female undergraduates graduating, which that's the first step, right? Like we got to get that first.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, like in issues that are still, you know, strictly mostly right to related to women, like maternity leave policies, well, parental leave policies and mm-hmm. having those in place are very important. That's something that Texas is way behind, I would say, mm-hmm. in our institution here as well. These are things that need to be changed. And I think unless it's like high level, you know, state or federal policy to improve on that, it would be, you know, it's still a main challenge. So there are issues like that are still, you know, associated with a women career that need to be worked on. But overall, I agree with you. You know, it's looking good and promising, and I think we're in the right direction.
And it's really cool to see that, you know, you are obviously who you are, and who we are is shaped by so many different aspects of our lives, by the things that we've interacted with, the people who have shaped us. But also there are probably some intrinsic character qualities and features. But you add all those things up together, especially looking at things like the support from, you know, the MacArthur Genius Award or from L'Oreal and, you know, the different institutions that you've trained at and, mm-hmm. and the attention that you've gotten for the incredible work that you've done. And do you feel like you have a little bit more of a social justice outlook now than maybe you did when you first started as a scientist in those early days?
I think so. And I think being from Brazil helps on that too. You know, I feel like I have a better view of, you know, the reality of humankind in general than, you know, someone that didn't come from same background, because, you know, I did grow in a third world country underdeveloped country, and I would be more exposed to that, right? Like on an everyday. And, you know, my attitude towards, you know, these things is really feeling extremely privileged and fortunate to have received these recognitions. And they, you know, they make a huge impact. I see, like, by, you know, people that are now interested in working with me and people that are answering my emails and these kind of things, you know, it changes. So it also gives me the opportunity to, you know, pass it on. And I try to, you know, in my life, professional life, personal life, to also help others just advance in their careers and be better prepared and have the opportunity, some of the opportunities that I've had. So that's, you know, and that's very important to me. And I, again, don't try not to take these things for granted, but really use these as opportunities to also, serve others and help others in their careers as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, you mentioned being in Texas now. It's been a few years since you've been on faculty there at UT. So that's in Austin, Texas. I actually grew up in North Texas in the DFW area and lived there for most of my life before I left to go to New York and then ultimately Los Angeles. And it's, you know, culture shock for me. Like, I think I'm really thriving here in LA. It feels like this is, you know, my culture. And there are things about Texas that I love and I miss. And I have a giant Texas tattoo on my arm. But at the same time, there were things about living in Texas that were incredibly trying for me as a person who's a little more progressive, a little bit more liberal, because, you know, it's a different, our country is in many ways, I shouldn't say split, but there are tonal differences throughout the country. That's not to say that there aren't, there isn't a lot of interesting mixing all marbled in. But how has it been for you going from, you know, Stanford, for example, to UT, which, but let's be honest, like Austin is a very blue island in the middle of Texas. But still, it's a very different kind of place to live, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember when, I'm kind of laughing because it's such a funny story, when I the offer from UT, it was the best offer I got for, you know, my faculty position. I remember I was walking down the hallway at Stanford and I met this one professor that, you know, is incredible, super accomplished, man. And I told him, like, I was so excited. I said, oh my gosh, look, I just got this offer from UT. And the first thing comes out of his mouth is, but you don't want to go to Texas, do you? And I said, hey, what's the issue? Austin is special. As you said, Austin is very special. I think it's very diverse. That was something that was very important to me, more than like politics. You know, like I struggled in Indiana because I felt like I didn't fit. I didn't have, you know, as many immigrants there and people that, you know, I could identify more with. So in California, you know, in the Bay Area, that was a lot easier for me to, you know, build relationships and have a sense of belonging. And in Austin, it's kind of felt the same that in California. So the nice. Transition hasn't been so hard. And it's a beautiful city. We have a lot of you know, rivers and lakes and so on, you know, so it's a great place to be. And, you know, I have three children and it's a great place to raise a family as well. So I'm pretty happy here.
I love that. That's really good to hear. And you got to admit, the weather is great.
It is. It's a bit steamy and it's summer.
How does it compare to the weather in Brazil?
So that's the thing. It's very similar. Very, very similar. So for me, it was not a hard transition, and I would rather be hot and steamy in the summer than under snow. So for like 6 months. So I really like the weather here.
100%. I'm right there with you. I have to be honest. Well, so, you know, we've talked quite a bit about the transitions of your career and about, you know, the work towards what's basically now this really incredible research tool, the mass spec pen. Is that where most of your lab is focusing their attention now, is iterating the mass spec pen, looking at the data that you're receiving from it and getting it to the point where it's going to be, because right now it's a research tool, right? Mm-hmm. So getting it to the point where it's going to be a viable market tool?
Yeah, I mean, I would say maybe 40% of our effort is with the mass spec pen. So okay. It's a large portion of our research, but we do have several other projects that are not in the operating room, I would say. I have a few other projects that are, you know, more like a basic understanding, cancer, you know, biochemistry and expression of different markers, better diagnose disease, better understand disease. But also more in the clinical applications, we're looking at preoperative diagnosis, like from, fine needle aspirate biopsies and, issues with certain cancer types that cannot be recognized by the standard clinical method. So we actually are, you know, we have many projects, and the mass spec pen is a major component, but there are a lot of interesting problems that we are currently investigating.
Very cool. But there still seems to be this really tight crossover between analytical chemistry and molecular biology that's really calling to you.
Yeah. Yes. I don't have, some of our projects are like method development, but the goal is for better, you know, analysis of tissues and biology and so on. So yeah, so we're really, and I try to keep it focused. I think, you know, there are very, maybe two projects that like bio-related, they're more like physics and natural products. But the, like 90% of my research is in biomedical.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, gosh, Livia, I've learned so much. This has been so fascinating. I'm so excited about your projects because they really have such potential to affect people's lives for the better. And how often do people really get to say that about their work in a meaningful way? I would love to kind of maybe close our conversation by asking you the same two questions that I ask all of the guests on the show. And they're sort of big picture questions. So are you ready for that?
I'll try, okay? I'll try.
All right. So I want you to think about the future, and you can really think about it in whatever context is relevant to you right now as we're speaking. But the first thing I want to know is, you know, what is the thing, if you had to pick one thing, which I know is not easy, that is really keeping you up at night, the thing that you're maybe truly concerned about and potentially even a little pessimistic, maybe a little cynical, just something that you legitimately are worried about. But then on the flip side of that, to end it on a little bit of a higher note, what is the thing that you're actually fundamentally optimistic about? What are you really looking forward to?
Oh, wow. These are hard. Yeah. So I think it goes back to my background, because where I grew up in and so on, I've seen a lot of social injustice and, you know, I'm very passionate about, people. I'm normally thinking about life and how to improve, right? Life, that's the basis of cancer research. I think deeply about this all the time. Like, why are we doing what we're doing? Well, because we want people to live longer, right? We want our dear and loved ones to be around. We want to have, better quality of life and so on. So, you know, I think about, human trafficking. That's something that I've been involved in the past. Sex trafficking, how many young girls are treated sexually in other countries and start of terrible schemes of just being taken from families and so on. That's something that is, you know, blows my mind. That's still ongoing in modern day slavery. You know, these things are just seem to be, you know, as I said, it's so concerning because it just feels like it shouldn't be around anymore. You know, there's just so much awareness, but still ongoing. So things like this are really things that worry me. Also, social justice and even like basic needs. Like I see in Brazil, like issues just hunger in extreme poverty, and how can we really change that to give children opportunities to come out of that cycle? You go to Rio de Janeiro, I was just there in December, and you go through these favelas and you see like it's just a cycle of poverty. People are stuck in these environments that we need to be able to capture them and take them out of this. And just like the gap right in between the rich and the poor is just, it's just so concerning. So absolutely, these are things that I think a lot about. Something that I think is looking good. I think like the exchange of information and exchange of people and just the ability to know what's going on in the world and work collectively towards improving current problems, like, you know, in health related research. This, we kind of talked a little bit about this, but just the ability to work with people across the globe in solving these big problems is something that's really exciting. And I feel like that's going to continue to happen, and we're collectively going to be able to solve big problems that are still ongoing.
Absolutely. And how cool and how inspirational that you get to be a part of this, you know, joint solution to these issues. I think that, you know, you have inspired already so many young women, and there's still so many more people, I think, whose lives are going to be touched by your work and by your example. And it was really, honestly, an honor to chat with you for this hour. Thank you so much for joining us and for telling us your story.
Thank you. It was really fun. Love doing this.
Awesome. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.